Hello and welcome to Shooting the Ghost, a secret life of movies with your host Jason Horsley. This is not stormy weather. This is not Ale Escapers. This is not what you thought it would be. This is an exploration of the psyche of one individual, but it's also the exploration of the psyche of three individuals that you're about to hear. The three individuals in question: myself, Phil Snyder, Frustrated Rider, and Bill Morrison, Balloon Man. I've known Bill and Phil for many years, and we decided to get together and discuss this area, Sam Peckinpah, creative obsession and whatnot, all the various subjects around that personage that I've chosen to focus on for my own good reasons. Initially, Phil, Bill and I, my intention was to get us together and to read from the novel that I wrote, Shooting the Ghost, the Ballad of Sam Peckinpah, which is a non-fiction novel that covered Sam's life from his birth through to his death, in a more or less accurate autobiographical or biographical fashion, with, of course, some departures from reality as I ventured into the archetypal realms of myth and psychology and whatnot, and put my own spin on the story. Anyway, the intention, yes, was to read from this novel, but after several attempts to do so and the chaos that ensued, I've decided to simply select highlights from our conversation, at least to begin with, around the subject of Sam Peckinpah. This podcast isn't really about Sam, exactly. it's certainly not about his film career. But it does refer to him and begins and ends with the person of Sam Peckinpah, what he means to the three of us. But what you're about to hear, essentially, is a woven commentary of three psyches interacting, dancing around one another. Three concentric circles, you might even say. The clown, the psychopath, the hero. I'll leave you to decide who is who. And the ways in which we reflect and oppose and challenge one another in this life and in this journey and in this present conversation. It's a very complex narrative with many different threads that are woven together at subtler levels. It may not be obvious in first listening. They certainly weren't obvious to me at the time as I was having these conversations, but I did, of course, have a sense that certain notes were being struck and certain themes were occurring and recurring. The themes, such as they are, relate to the shadow, to the inner primal, the devil, to the dream life, and such like, to the creative obsession, to the heroic quest, and the parallels between that and the psychopathic journey. My own personal history is also woven into this conversation, perhaps inevitably, and perhaps more than I would be comfortable with were it in another context. So, without further ado then, let's proceed to this trilogue between three very, very different and yet curiously complementary male psyches.
Yeah, what do you get to when you get to the end of God or something? Oh, how about that? Who created God? I mean, why am I laughing? Well, yeah, well, who did? The Big Bang, you know. Who created God? Since I was born, our universe has expanded by I don't know how many light years or something, whatever. I mean, you know, we're keep exploding out before the implosion or some damn thing. So it seemed to me like we were only 6 billion when I was, a kid. And now, what is it, 15 billion years our universe has been... our galaxy. The dinosaurs seem to stay the same pretty much, though. But our age of ourselves doesn't it? It
we don't know, do we?
Dragging its knuckles.
All we know is what they're telling us, you know, and we don't really know that the Earth goes around the Sun or the Sun goes around the Earth.
Really?
Well, no. How do we know that? How do we know anything except by believing what we're told or ignoring all that crap and just basing it on our direct experience?
This part here between what we're doing, of course you're recording it, but would be a part of the whole thing. Even predominant, or not predominant, but parallel to the importance of Sam Peckinpah himself would be this extraneous stuff.
Yeah, well, it would be a very interesting and unusual show. It would be a very long one, I think.
Yeah, and we don't want that. We want it short as possible.
I think
how long
so.
Is the book, by the way?
How long is the book? It is, I think it's about 180,000 words. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. If that means anything to you in words. I mean, you know, word count.
I was trying to put that one together. It seemed, what's that, 400 pages?
Matrix Warrior is 60,000 words, so you're talking three times as long as Matrix Warrior.
Yeah, I'm looking at that right in the bookcase right now, so that means it's three times as big, huh?
Right.
Or is it a different size?
Well, it's not any size at all. Because it's just on, you know, a document on my computer right now.
Lee Marvin, I mean, do we want to say something about these people? I mean, all of them. Because everybody that's in the Sam Peckinpah book, almost everybody I know of and even have met, you know?
Not including
Lee. And then now
Lee
we
Marvin.
Get in, so...
You haven't met Lee
not
Marvin.
Not Lee Marvin, no. But my first impression of Lee was in a picture that was black and white, as I remember, and he popped into a restaurant with a gun or something like that. He was very, very mean and violent, and I can't remember the picture of it. But
yeah, I mean, Lee Marvin didn't actually mean that much to me until I met Phil. I mean, obviously I was aware of him. That's right, I'd written about him. I'd written about him in Blood Poets, and I'd started, like with many things in Blood Poets, once I started looking at them with an eye to write about them, I found new meanings in them, films and actors and what have you. And that happened with Lee Marvin. I started looking at Lee Marvin, not closely, because I wasn't writing about him or a film, but I was writing about the anti-hero and the genesis of the anti-hero from Robert Mitchum through to Clint Eastwood. And then I sort of hit on Lee Marvin, interesting. And then that led me to Phil's site. Somehow I found the Sons of Lee Marvin. And this was in very, very early days of the internet, at least for me. What, 98 or 97, something like that. And that was how Phil and I met, through the Lee Marvin connection.
Yeah, I remember now. And through that, why I was emailing Phil, and Phil mentioned you at the letter that you had sent him, and what stands out is that airport experience that you had. I think it was in Mexico someplace.
That was trying to get to Mexico. No, trying to get to San Francisco.
You know, what you said about the people at the airport checking you in and reviewing you to make sure you were okay, and what you went through that time, and the dimension that I thought you gave the one particular airport personnel that you dealt with was
Johnson.
Extraordinary.
Agent Johnson. Yeah, that would have been a while after, wouldn't it? Because Phil and I met about 97.
I fell in love with you at that time, Jake, you know, in the sense of a rapport of an appreciation for someone who is so sensitive and aware of what's going on around and under dire circumstances for oneself, in your case.
Those dire circumstances continue to dog me, but... I kind of left
You know why I laugh? I mean, partly because you laugh at tragedy, but because within that, of course, your tragedy is your great expression that almost seems to feed off of living the kind of a lifestyle you've chosen for yourself. You go away a fortune at the outset, for heaven's sakes, to be on a level in which you could experience what you wouldn't maybe have otherwise had you had some money.
Yeah, well, that was partly why I got rid of the money, I guess. Well, it wasn't really thought out that way, but I did know instinctively that it would allow that. It's kind of the rite of passage, you know. I was growing up on those movies and unconsciously emulating the hero on his journey, so you can't really do that if you're mollycoddled by, you know, daddy's money. Bring it back to Sam, and that period was...
Yeah, it gets close to Sam, it seems like, right now. Sam and Marie. I don't know what your attitude is towards your mother. I've always felt like you had a pretty good relationship with your mom.
Well, don't get me started. No, we're not going to go there on that subject.
Well, why this obsession with Sam Peckinpah and his dysfunctional family, his mom and pop,
and the
impact?
The thing about Sam, I mean, the obsession with Sam is to do with an affinity with him, which I did discover during this time that I first met Phil. I mean, Phil will remember that was when I first started. It was actually corresponding with Phil by email, talking about these different characters, actors, personalities, movies, that somehow the Sam Peckinpah archetype, if you like, began to form. In I guess our mind, but particularly took root in mine, because it was during that period that I started working on the script to bring me the head of Sam Peckinpah. Do you remember, Phil? Because a lot of it came from our dialogues.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yes, I do recall.
I immersed myself in Sam's psyche to write the script. I don't know, maybe it took 2-3 months, but it was very intense. And I was, and by the end of it, I was actually dreaming about Sam Peckinpah. And a few years later, then I wrote the novel, and so then I had to go that much deeper to actually flesh it out. But to answer what you brought up about the obsession with, it's not an obsession with Sam's family or patterns or anything. It's an obsession with my own, which I can't help. You can't help but be obsessed with your own obsessions, can you? Because that's what they're there for. So, I mean, it was seeing the way that Sam's patterns matched my own, you know? And the it was such a key thing, Sam's relationship with his mother. You know, that really was like... But that's true. Isn't that true of all of us? When you get right down to it? That's what really fucks us up from day one. Is, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, once again, I'd like to bring in my wonderful family life, but I had the same kinds of experiences every son and daughter has with breaking away from the nest and figuring in some ways they're not. Well, I don't want to go on with that because I had such a great. I think I was understood, you know. I wasn't guided. In any way, and that maybe was a brother, but it was not dysfunctional, my family, you know, for one thing. In terms of love and appreciation, I mean, it was a balanced setup. Mother and pop and mom, they were both strong and they were both weak, and they both had their, they both were dependent and independent of each other, both of them, and do I make sense? I mean, in that sense, and as far what they were gave to me was being a middle born and the first born of their marriage was I got such an extraordinary bit of spoiledness from both sides of the family, although I wouldn't have known it at the time. And it wasn't as though I was given everything, and that by no means, you know. I sold Liberty and Collier magazines door to door when I was 8 and 9 in the neighborhood. I mean, that was doing something that. That they thought was appropriate to maybe a people that did come from the farm to begin with. Their people did anyway, and you got to get out and do some work in that. I mean, I did that, paper routes and that. This is not my story, but it is regarding Sam Peckinpah and family. When I read about Marie and when I read about Sam and Daniel, Sam's father, and their relationship, none of that stuff went on, that kind of thing. my dad didn't. My dad set a pace, yes, for sure. And I thank him for all of my life, because to me it was a very balanced person, a generous man, even though he was Republican and had some dysfunctional things in terms of a philosophy in some ways. But boy, I sure got a good balance. I think a majority of people do.
There you lost me, Bill. I was just thinking that it was refreshing to hear your take because of how unusual it is to hear that. But I also think it's I think it's unusual to hear it because I think it's unusual, period. I really do. I think that.
Sure you do. Sure you do. You don't want your life to crumble beneath you. And
well, I don't know about that.
Yeah. Hmm? Can I say something? And I know that that it's probably not my turn, but Sam Peckinpah. I mean, it's interesting how he's been a part of bringing the three of us together, and how important he still is. Hmm. I'm getting reintroduced to the guy, as a consequence of reading your material. For heaven's sakes, I feel a part of the family. And Matthew Peckinpah, the son. I recall directed an MM show. What's early it? On in the 80s. My gosh.
What's the MM?
Mr. Morrison.
Oh, okay. So that is curious that you met both his son, and his oldest daughter, his only son, isn't it, Matt? And Sharon would be his
oldest
daughter.
Yeah, and Sam himself.
And Sam himself, yeah.
At that shoot with Craig Nelson, Losterman's Weekend, and up over the garage at location. Craig brought me upstairs at this authentic garage, of course, that's what it was, and where Sam was having his office up above, in where they did the paperwork, I suppose, for the garage. Craig would have said something like, my friend Bill Morrison, and Sam tripped over and damn near fell on his face coming towards me to shake my hand. Because he was blasted, you know. But I wish I could remember more. He seemed like a very nice chap. What an honor to be directed by him, too. Yeah. You know, I mean, that would have been. But you'd probably walk off the set just like he did with Brando and One Eye Jackson, saying that's when he learned how to hate. In his film world, I guess, anyway, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Was working with Brando. Jack Nicholson said much the same thing, in a sense, with that Missouri Breaks, when Brando kept him waiting in that mud puddle for way, way, way too long and finally came out. Huh. That ass old Brando.
Anyway, I guess Sam Peckinpah, to me, this isn't why I wrote the thing by any means, but it's a cautionary tale, you know? And it's also a tragedy. And the whole notion of tragedy is one that I think has kind of lost its meaning in our culture, not to get pretentious about it, but people talk about this and that being a tragedy, but my idea of a tragedy is the Shakespearean sense of a you know, great man gone bad, or a somebody with great potential who has one fatal flaw, and that weakness, because it's like a vehicle that's going incredibly fast. It's got all this power, it's got this beautiful engine, beautiful design, but if there's one flaw in it, you know, it gets to 100 and it crashes and burns because of all the power. So the more power you have as an individual, the more fatal that flaw becomes, the more dangerous. And that's what tragedy is to me, and that's what Peckinpah was. He had this incredible potential, which we can see in Wild Bunch and some of his other work, like real genius. Who's a really poetic soul, which you can also see in the Wild Bunch, if you don't, you know. A lot of people just see it as an action movie, but of course it's so much more than that, and it's there. And when
I've seen movies differently because of you, really, and that's interesting, because you've actually shown me what to look for sometimes, I think, and that there's a bigger picture here, Bill. As I say, that Matrix review that you laid on me and began that process, I think, of me seeing more metaphor and more of what a movie is about. But sometimes I often think that is a consequence of the reviewer reading into it what they would like to see more than maybe what is actually in there. No. As far as the
I don't know, I mean, that can be the case, but with Peckinpah, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, you look at the Wild Bunch, there really are these poignant poetic lines. So that gives you a clue, that gives you a really strong indication that it was made by a poetic soul. But then if you actually look into Peckinpah's life and his interviews and stuff, he really was, you know, he wasn't this macho blowhard that he tried to pretend to be. That was clearly his cover. That was this act that he put on to protect himself, as it were. You know, it didn't work, of course, from protect that vulnerable feminine poetic nature. And you know, I think that's what's fascinating about Sam, is that it shows, his story just shows like the price that a creative individual pays when he tries to kind of distort himself in order to be successful, in order to fit in with the world and people's expectations, because it's just crippling. Mm-hmm. And so he did it through drinking. I mean, that was kind of a self-medication, isn't it? If you just keep drunk the whole time, you can, you know, whatever, you become something that basically you despise, but you know, you're numb to that.
Yeah, reminding me of a Lenny Bruce line was that you got to be careful that you don't become what you most despise. And of course, that's not his line, but I remember it from him.
Mm, well, I mean, that's the thing with working in Hollywood.
And I think he did become what he despised. You know, that's why he was close to that.
Yeah. Just see.
Phil does not have that problem.
Do what problem? What problem would that be?
Becoming what you despise.
All right.
Oh yeah. I don't have to become, and I would think I was born what I despise, so there's no becoming there.
Who created God?
Everything with the man and the woman, at least at a personal level, and this is my experience, but I'm guessing it's probably yours too, is comes down to a battle of wills. You know, the male and the female. And what I was thinking about today as well, when I was thinking about this basic need for men to dominate women, which comes out in actual abuse, because they don't know how to control their women or contain them, and so the only thing they can do, resort to, is physical violence or verbal abuse, and to keep them down, because a woman, it just can't be controlled. You know, that we can't even understand women, much less control them. So I forgot what I was going to say now. That it relates to this terror we have as men, that we're going to be overwhelmed by women, by their power.
Well, Sam Peckinpah had a lot of this concerns this way. I think the man, see, the way I read him is he's all fucked up, and I've told you that. I just think he's really has a slant about family and women, everybody actually.
But we're all fucked up.
And see, even
all of us. You know, Sam just acted it out a lot more, and he was famous, and so he was under the spotlight, and then I put him under the spotlight to show all his flaws. But you know, nobody has a clean record, and we're all driven by these same distortions and same patterns, however sort of idyllic we think our upbringing was.
A person who does it is kind of heroic, almost, even though they can be an asshole like this. Picasso, I mean, name anybody, I guess, huh? Nietzsche, I mean, I drop names, you know. Socrates, I guess not. Was kind of a loner, wasn't he? He didn't have any women, did he? Socrates, was he married?
I don't know about Socrates' personal history.
Yeah. Socrates and his marriage, yeah. Two times, I believe.
Well, I think, you know,
that's right.
I think if you bring it back to passion, you know, these artistic creative types, by definition, have got more energy, more passion than your average person, and so that it magnifies everything. And if they
and dysfunction causes that.
Causes which?
A person to be extraordinary so often. They're just set off. They don't settle easily. They're not satisfied.
Well, that's true too. Yeah. That's part
like
of it,
we
too.
We talk about you, I guess, in the sense. We could. That's an example.
Yeah.
Very easily. And it gives you a heroism, too, to all of your friends, I think, you know, even though we know you. But it is. It's heroic what you put yourself through traveling and with Liz and so on and so forth, too, as well. And it's, wow, I mean, you know, and not being accepted in the United States. Who knows what that's about? You're a heroic personality. You're not satisfied. And you're fucked up, yes. And it sounds like you came from a family that, in which you have had a few, you know, some problems like we all do. But there's something there about with the love thing, I think.
How do you mean? With the family love, you mean?
Mom and Dad?
Yeah.
I don't know. A kind of a...
Well, it was...
do I mean? Well, that's right. They do love you, don't they?
Well, it was too much and not enough.
Did your dad...
was the situation. It got too much love from my mother, which is to say the wrong kind of love, possessive love, and not enough from the father, almost none. So that created this very severe imbalance in me where I went running around the world trying to find a woman who would make me feel good and safe, and yet I couldn't actually give myself to a woman because I was bonded to the mother at such a deep level, and on the other hand, unable to connect to other men as peers and form alliances with them because I had such an awful start in life there with not just my father but my brother was hostile to me. So the first two men I knew rejected me, and that creates a pattern, you know. And there's nothing you can do about it except by going in it and being in it and going through it and seeing it for what it is, and then it changes of its own accord, I think, or it just dissolves once we've seen it for what it is. But you can't try to fight against it. Like you were saying, you know, the dysfunctions also drive creative types, and yeah, I mean, a lot of, if not all of my so-called heroics were kind of pathological behavior also. You might just as well call them that. Me being driven.
The only thing heroes are made of.
Yes.
Oh, now we're on pathology. Phil's, we're almost on the gap thesis.
Yeah, it's all converging here. I can hear it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I agree with Bill's assessment of you, Jason. You know, it is heroic, you know, but it's also really stupid and crazy at the same time. It's like, man, I admire that guy. Boy. I'm glad my life is like that. I can never do that. Is he fucking stupid or crazy or what? And then, but you still, you know, admire and envy and respect. You know what I mean? So it's like a mix of all that kind of shit. You know, there's no pure anything. You know, like you say, it's pathological. Mm. It did seem, yeah, it was pathological. It was fucked up, man. So I remember reading, you know, when I was, you know, when you were working on the autobiographical piece, the
novel.
I can't remember what the title of it was now.
The
novelization of your experiences. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then you know about your family life. And I was at a fucking bookstore, Borders, big chain bookstore here, about 6 months or so ago. And I was just, you know, killing time on my break from work, and there was your brother's book on display. And you know, I just picked it up, said, "Oh, there's that fucker's book. Let me look at that." So I picked it up and I started thumbing through, and I mean. You know, just came upon a couple of things about, you know, your family and everything, and then thinking back about what I had heard, you know, based on, you know, the writings and the emails and things like that, and from you, and it's just like those Horsleys are fucked up. Man. The two most fucked up guys I've, you know, I can go down like in Ohio, in Dayton, where I live. There's a place, the area town East Dayton, and that's where the you know, the people they call them, I always myself refer to them as white trash. You know what I mean? It's like where all the scumbags and the, you know, lower, you know, class sort of people and everything. And, you know, it's a very similar sort of thing. You know, it's like a upper class sort of background. You know what I mean? But it's still the same level of, man, you were really fucked up by your parents, too. You know, I mean, it's as I was. You know, it's a lot of self-recognition in that, too. But, yeah, I mean.
Right.
Definitely, it's all rooted in that pathology and that just like Bill's the word that Bill used in an email a long time ago that I always liked, and I think you've used it recently too. Fucked upness, you know, it's just the general fucked upness, you know.
What gets me, Jake? Excuse me, or Jake? What gets me is that you know we know all of these things, and now you are getting, or you are getting. I can only speak for you. And that is now you're accepting, you're really accepting. What can you do about it except go moment to moment? And if anybody went moment to moment, it was you anyway. But I mean, you go just as it is. You accept your life as it is. And at my age, I can tell you I'm doing a lot of that these days. I think there's been a big change from 74 to 75 in the sciatic business. But I hear you talking about that. But you came up with a beautiful cap to it. I'm going back, retracking. But you came up with a beautiful cap to it. And that is the wisdom of being who you are and not letting it bother you so much or something. That isn't quite as it either, is it? I'm afraid.
That's close enough. Yeah, I mean, the hero's quest is, if it gets directed outward, then it does become psychopathic, right, Phil? I mean, it's just, there's no way.
Right.
We can't transform ourselves by doing stuff. We can only, it has to go inward, the hero's journey, because the wound, you know, I think what we were talking about here, what we're getting at, and it ties in with Sam beautifully, is that the heroic sort of character or temperament comes from these generational wounds which get passed on over generations, and they get worse and worse and worse as the thing, the patterns, the distortion gets deeper and deeper until somebody's born like myself where the distortion, the patterns are so awful, let's say, and not in, you know, it's not like I was raised by Myra Hindley or anything, I wasn't sexually abused, but still the distortion was just right there, you know, and inescapable right from day one. And so that creates...
So why are we united, we three? I mean, sort of I can see you and Phil, and I can understand myself too, and I guess it's a rhetorical question I could answer myself almost.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it?
Because
you, I was linked to you via Phil, and Phil and I are, in certain ways, peas in a pod. We're both Aries. We're different.
Yeah.
We're definitely in different sort of octaves. Yeah.
I'll tell you, I mean... I think where Bill comes in, at least to start off with, for me anyways, is, you know, I mean, because of the lack of a relatively stable father figure who provided some sense of guidance, even passive as a model, just showing you how do you live in the world kind of thing. I kind of lacked that, you know what I mean? I didn't really have that, and what I had was kind of, you know, he guided me in like the wrong directions kind of thing, you know? So, you know, always looking for that. I was like, well, why would I be fascinated by Lee Marvin? Why would I be fascinated by anything that I like? It's sort of a search for a guide figure, an older male figure. You could call it a father figure. You know, I'm not looking for an actual... But, you know, when Bill, I mean, that first time I saw that your show, Bill, I mean, that, it was just perfect episode. It's like, this guy, you know, this... You know, it's you are maybe the father figure in this, the two brothers here. You know what I mean? Who can show two fucked up guys who are relatively independent? I won't want to say creative. I know Jake is. I attempt, but struggling to express themselves in the world. And here's this guy on the screen and is expressing himself through all this pain and difficulty. You know, all the permutations and the tribulation that you have to go through to get things out as the balloon man. In those early episodes, you know, it's like, I can't remember.
Well, you know, I think Phil's onto something here, because I don't have father figures myself, you know, and I'm also looking for them, not in a literal sense, but as in at least to see that it is possible for somebody to, the idea of a functioning role model. Who's older? It has to be older, really, to be a role model. It's just so damn hard to find these. You know, just to know it exists. It's not about following it or listening to their wisdom or anything like that, but just to know that they're out there.
Who created God?
I mean, have you ever tried interpreting the events of your life in the same way that you'd interpret a dream, for their symbolic content?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's... Right, yeah. For me, was always the key, you know? To look at life as if it was a dream or a movie and interpret it as such.
Well, if my life were a dream, I should have been hung about 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because I don't think there's any advantage to a creature that has sometimes performed in my dreams. I really mean that. So, I don't know. I do know as far as dreams go and as far as the devil is concerned. And Jake understands, and I guess you do too, Phil, as far as my association with the validity of that there is a devil, and that is that we do have these two sides to us for sure, and I don't think I'm saying anything new. But I let the devil in early in dreams. I remember in my teens, there were dreams I had. I could have shut the devil out. You have a control in your dreams. To a great extent, you can actually stop things from happening. You just won't allow it to happen. You make your decision in the dream. And I always opened up to it, to most all of the devilish schemes, and it makes me think, because it's not that attractive. And I have appreciation for people who are much more set on that, and that they don't allow the devil into their dreams. They just stop it.
Well,
he tries to creep in.
That's repression, though. You see, what you're describing to me is real shamanism, and that's what I would admire most in somebody, you know. That's what I admire most, and that's what I aspire most in myself, is to let the devil in. To let it all in, all the stuff that we hate and despise and loathe and fear about ourselves and about others, just to open to it and let it in. I think that's truly the only way to become whole. So I very much understand what you're describing, and personally I think that,
Well, I agree with that totally. That philosophy of yours, Jason.
I had a dream vision just a few nights ago, which is like it came at a turning point in my life. The dream was that I was conscious of being in darkness, being in the void, and I was moving through the void as consciousness, and I was aware that this was a dream experience, and that it would end whenever I needed it to end. But I was also aware that this was a forerunner, a taste of what was coming at the end of my life, and that this was what death will be like. And it was the experience of moving through the darkness, the endless night of the abyss, and there being nothing there but my own consciousness, is completely isolated and alone, surrounded by this void or this abyss. And as I say, I knew very just this overwhelmingly intense awareness that this day would come, this moment would come when I was experiencing this, and that would be it, that I'd be moving into that abyss. There would be no coming back, there'd be no returning. I would either make it to the other side of the abyss, or I would just get lost in that abyss. And the thing about the abyss was that because there was nothing there but my consciousness, the only reality that was going to arise within that abyss was what I summoned with my consciousness, or created or projected. just as the dreaming mind, you know, projects images and creates forms of reality from consciousness. And so as aware of this, I became aware of the fear, of course, of what reality I was going to create. And I began to perceive images before my eyes, initially kind of abstract, geometrical, and then this form began to appear, which was of this feral, beast-like, humanoid figure, wild, ferocious, and that was pink-coloured, it was rosy-coloured, so very satanic image, you might say, but more pure, more primal than that. It wasn't some Christian idea of the devil. You know, it was just this primal, fierce, ferocious entity that I was summoning or creating with my consciousness.
May I say something here about that pink color, Jake? Not to stop the flow, but the pink. The pink is a very soft, transitional color from a spectrum of red to white almost. And so I don't quite get the tie-in with pink as being an essential. I don't know what that says to me. That's what I'm saying in regards to this.
You mean you don't see the association of pink with the devil? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Well, because of the way that Satan's depicted in images, he's so often this, you know, fierce creature with the red skin, with the pink skin.
Yes.
So, yeah,
not
I didn't.
Not pink.
Well, pink as in rosy pink. It was a dark pink, I guess. I didn't have the association at the time. I didn't think, oh my God, that's Satan. I was fully aware that this is, you know, this is my consciousness. This is an aspect of my psyche that was materializing. It was only after when I woke up that I thought, well, maybe this is how the devil comes into being, you know, as we project. Oh. Our fear outward, and then we create an image out of it, and of what we're most afraid of, which is primal. And
I don't know. The devil appeared to me in my early dreams as a first of all, without an actual appearance of the devil, anthropomorphic, idolized and made with horns and tail. Right. Now later, just by the fact is that there was the devil. This is not a good way to be in my dreams. There's nothing. This is not a good adventure in my dreams. Not at all. This is not a sweet thing at all. This is not good. Later, though, he appeared a time or two, and one time I remember perfectly as a definitive creature of which the graphic I am quite familiar with, and that is he was green, slime, cum all over him, and he had horns, and he was waggling his tail at me, and this is a dream, and suggesting, what do you mean? You don't want to come here. Come in here. This is your kind of world, to enter this world. And I entered it. Hmm. And I've been there a time or two in my dreams, I must say. And it's a slimy world. It really is. Right. I have allowed myself to get into it, and I give myself the okay with it is that simply has been my nature. I decided to do such a thing, to enter this kind of to allow myself not to fight it even in my dreams when I could have, because I it just seemed to me that it was going to be very interesting.
Well, was it? Well, I mean, this world that you entered, I mean.
Oh, yes.
What, do you have more details about this world, or?
Well, lots of it has to do with a sexual kind of a deviation, but in some of these dreams I've had where the devil was not at all prominent, but I was doing devilish things, I've killed people.
Yeah.
And always throughout that killing, very seldom has this occurred. Very rare, I must say. But I have, and I remember one dream in which there were two people involved, or three, and there was a gun that was slid over by the foot to me, and I picked it up and I killed somebody. It was out of desperation. I mean, I had to do it. There have been other times I've been killed, too, in dreams.
Would you say that it's fair to say that you are probably a relatively peaceful person, you know, in your life? I mean, I don't want to.
Well, we know
you
that.
Know, I mean, you have expressed an affinity to a lot of the culture of the '60s, that being a Camelot sort of period for you and to you. I don't know
about that.
Maybe you say?
It sounds to me like you're being very newsy about this. And
well, I'm just wondering if in your outward life you're a little more dedicated to being peaceful and sort of a live and let live kind of guy.
Oh yes, yeah. Well, we
know
this.
In dreams, you become more evil. Whereas I really don't dream doing evil things, but I think about it while I'm awake, and I say mean, horrible things about people and to people. You know, sometimes. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So are you suppressing something that is only expressing?
I think that too. I do that what you do. I think you're more exaggerated with it, and more open about it.
Yeah.
Well, that's something else again. I think you're a little bit more closer to it. Let's say.
Yeah.
In the real life than I am. Yes. Closer to being. To what are we talking about? We're talking about killing. We're not talking about sexual antics, though.
Well, I was going to ask
because I don't think we're any different in that sense. You almost want to reach out and grab a crotch or grab a bun at work. You know, I mean, it's like you just almost want to do it in real life. And so, consequently, as I might say, it points me to the serial sick person who actually does act out these things. Mm-hmm. And now we can get into Sam Peckinpah in the sense that he acted out a lot of stuff. He was safe. He was within the circus industry, film making, television. It's all nuts. And it was perfect for a man of his stature. He certainly shouldn't have been a judge. Maybe his father should have been. I don't know. But, you know, it's...
I mean, what you're talking about is Peckinpah, he projected his demons onto the screen, which is a healthy way. If you project your demons onto other people, then you're a psychopath. And if you project them onto the screen,
I think that's a disservice to spread that bullshit to us. I loved that, the Wild Bunch. He had
the
greatest
about?
Of people...
Yeah, but it was an expression of suicidal impulse.
Demons. I don't know the demons.
Well, demons are what we wrestle with. Our own lower nature, our own fears, our own dementias, our own obsessions, our own petty, ugly lower self, our personal self. It's just a swamp, of a cesspit of self-loathing, as Phil will definitely back me up on.
Yeah, I'm kind of an Emersonian in the sense that beauty is where you want to find it always, and you can eliminate evil almost if you think beautifully all the time, and that will spread and make it more beautiful. If you think that way, it's more likely that the edge will be towards beauty and not the evilness of things.
But if you can't
I do
find
have that
beauty,
going for me.
If you can't find beauty in the ugliest things, then beauty will never prevail. It will never vanquish. It's not, beauty isn't about denying the ugly. It's about transforming what we perceive as ugly with our distorted psyches into what it truly is.
Absolutely.
Which is beauty. And that's what Peckinpah did with Wild Bunch, the one movie at least. He totally succeeded, in my opinion. He turned something that was twisted and distorted and these ugly brutish men, he turned it into a myth and a thing of beauty.
I see. I want to tell you something. It's revealing, and you should know this yourself, Jake, as a reviewer, and that is, I'll never get to quite that point where you are. I understand precisely that what you're saying is absolutely true. That what we have here is a poetry of a film. We're talking now film as being literature when it's done properly, and then now we're talking poetry. I mean, do we get an essence of stuff here? And you're saying Peckinpah reached, and he had the greatest of people working with him, for Christ's sake, who also had a great understanding of something that was very special in order for them to ever reach the acting state that they did, where they conveyed this kind of understanding of stuff.
Yeah.
We could all. He had those people.
Well, he infected them, I think, with his passion. I think that's what.
He has to be almost as big or bigger than them.
It's being a general, isn't it? It's like being a general on the battlefield. Inspire your troops with fearlessness and with the sense of courage and of power that they will prevail, kind of thing. And that, in the case of the Wild Bunch, it was bringing Peckinpah's vision to the screen in the fullest, richest possible way. And it wasn't, he himself couldn't have foreseen the end result, but he was able to know at some deep level what it was to tune into this myth, these archetypes, and to be inspired by that, the passion, and the self-loathing and his demons is all part of his passion, I would say, because he was battling, every minute of his life, he was battling with these demons, and making movies was the only way.
It's not worth it to me.
No, well,
it's not worth it to me. I must bring myself into battling. I battle enough demons, but God, there's just a constant agitation that a person like this goes through.
Well, I think Peckinpah got addicted
in
to it.
An artist like this.
That's the problem. I think he got hooked on it, and he got hooked on making movies, and then he got sucked into fighting the wrong battles, fighting battles with external enemies instead of... And it's not even a battle with the inner enemy. It's like you described in the dream. It's just going into that swampy realm and seeing what's there. We don't have to fight anything. We just have to open to it and let it be what it is, and then it will transform its nature, because it's suppressing that stuff.
It's the transforming, though, that I don't quite... I don't know what that leads to. The transforming. That's obvious. You don't know what it leads to, but... Right. It's got to lead to a happiness, a satisfaction of soul.
Well, not personally, though. It doesn't. The personal self can't survive the transformation. That's the rub. That's why so many individuals end up as psychopaths, because they can't let go of the personal self, and so they try to contain or control the transformation process and channel it into the personal self, and then the personal self becomes this hideous monster, right, Phil?
Yeah, okay.
Just bringing you in there.
Phil was...
Yeah. Well, he dropped off. I'm looking for Spot to jump in. You know, I don't want to get in the way of anything. Yeah.
He's pretty well expended himself. Well, okay, true. Let the others be buffoons for a while.
Yeah, we just sit and wait until we get the next chance to dominate the conversation. You know what I mean? So I'm just waiting for my next chance to dominate.
Well, gave you an opening there, but you blew it. So I guess.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really have a lot to say. I mean, I think at this point you could probably say more about the psychopath than I could. But I think you're still on track here. You're still on track.
We've all seen it in ourselves, and we've all seen it in the world, even if it's manufactured by media or what have you, and we've seen it in the movies. You know, this distortion and the very fine razor's edge between the shamanic experience or the shamanic embodiment and the psychopathic one. You know, because shamans transform themselves, literally speaking, but magically, you know, and they... You know, like a psychopath who murders women and cuts off their skin and tries to make a suit out of it. Shamans transform themselves. They become androgyne by other methods, you know, like piercing themselves is a way to create opening in the body, and so then they bleed, and so then they're imitating the female with the vagina and the menstruation. Even that's a coarse version of a much subtler process, which is this the integration of the other. You know, what is the other to the male? It's the female. You could throw out the devil, you throw out good and evil, you throw out all these bullshit polarities that we're programmed and brainwashed with by religion, and the only other, the only duality or polarity in this human realm is male and female. That's it. You know, that's what we're most afraid of, and that's as men, because
well,
it's
I hope
other.
We've helped, I hope we've helped you solve your problem today, Jake.
Yeah. Yeah, how can we help? We're here to help.
Who created God?